years, over the years from this place, but I've never had the opportunity to visit, and it's incredibly hospitable. I'm really having a good time. The title of the talk is this one, and the point why I call it a new golden age will become clear in a bit. I work in cosmology, but I have a deep fascination with general relativity and gravity, as most of us here. And so this is kind of a talk by a cosmologist to people working gravitational theory. It's a bit of a pitch. It's possibly a little bit too impressionistic for all the details, but I'm happy to discuss the details afterwards. But I want to give you a broad picture of something I think is happening at the moment, which I think is exciting. One of your compatriots was in London about a year ago, Vicky Caspi. She gave a fantastic talk at the Royal Society about pulsars. And she put up this plot, and this is a plot we've all seen many times, and it's a fantastic example of how you can use astrophysics to do fundamental research. It's a plot of the decay, of the orbital decay of a binary pulsar, and it can be incredibly well explained through general relativity and the gravitational radiation. The data points are the red dots, and GR is the blue line, and it's absolutely fantastic. We love this plot. From plots like this, looking at pulsars, we can get very tight constraints on gravity. Now, I would say that there is beginning to be an analogous plot in cosmology. This is a plot of the angular power spectrum of the cosmic microwave background. On the x-axis, we have inverse angular scale, so small scales, large scales here. On the y-axis, we have the amplitude of fluctuations, kind of the RMS and fluctuations on a given scale. And it has this quite elaborate shape. I've plotted on linear scale. If I plotted on log scale, you'd see that there was a plateau. Then you have a series of oscillations, and then you have damping. And all of this can be beautifully explained using general relativity and statistical physics. And I would argue that this is a stunning plot. This is a beautiful example of what some people have hubristically called precision cosmology. So I look at something like this, and I ask the question, I wonder if we can use this in the same way that we use measurements of pulsars to test gravity, to constrain gravity. Now, this is not something new. This is really the program of relativistic cosmology since the 1960s. This is what Seldovich and Peebles set out to do. These were people who were basically born in the forge of the rebirth of relativity and decided to look at the large-scale structure of the universe, the large-scale structure of space-time, to learn something about gravity and learn something about the universe. That's obvious. And what do I mean by that? I mean by that they pointed the way to look at how radiation is distributed on large scales and how the fluctuations are related to the evolution of the universe and how clustering of galaxies or how galaxies are distributed on large scales and how we may infer from that properties of the universe as a whole. This program has been incredibly successful. This is a nice example that often people forget. This is a paper from the 1990s, or 1990 to be precise, by Evstathiou and collaborators. And he did the following. He took a two-dimensional survey of galaxies, the APM survey, and he worked out the angular correlation function. And so this is large angles, small angles, and the dots are the angular correlation function. Then he worked out what a universe would look like if it was flat, full of cold dark matter with a little bit of baryons. And what he found was that you can't see the curve here, and I'm sorry, you got a curve which basically matched the dots and then cut off over here. It would underestimate large-scale power. He then did the same thing, including a cosmological constant, only doing linear theory, and he found that he could match the large scales, but he couldn't get the small scales. Now, if Stathew works on many different things, and amongst the things he works on are n-body simulations, so he can look at the nonlinear regime. And so he ran, with a few collaborators, a series of n-body codes, and he realized, can I just finish this? He realized that the small-scale structure would be boosted by nonlinear growth. And so he said, it's a qualitative argument, that if you included lambda, you could resolve the mismatch between small-scale power and large-scale power in the distribution of galaxies. And this is one of the first times that the case was made from large-scale structure for lambda. Now, please. Why are there two lambda? I don't know what the other curve is. I don't know what the dash curve is. You should look at this curve here.
The bottom.
the bottom one, which is done using linear theory, and then the solid line is including nonlinear corrections. So this is a very nice example of someone who started to, of beginning to use large-scale structure to make statements about the universe, and specifically quite a striking statement about lambda. Of course, I think a year later he wrote a paper making the case not for lambda, but for a massive neutrino. So he wasn't really committed to lambda. But it's a kind of game you could begin to play. And of course, we've gone very far. I plot here the angular power spectrum of the CMB. Again, amplitude of fluctuations and inverse angular scale. Over here, I plot the amplitude of mass fluctuations, of density fluctuations in galaxies, P of K. And over here, inverse wavelength. So small wavelengths here, large wavelengths here. The data here is from WMAP. The data here is from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. And this is an attempt not to have lambda. Take a universe, set lambda to zero, and see if you can fit it. And these are the best attempts. If you fix the Hubble constant to 72 kilometers per second to megaparsec, you just can't do it. And if you, of course, if you lower the Hubble constant to 44, you can, but that has problems of its own. And so the idea is that looking at the large-scale structure of the universe, you can make statements about the universe, about your underlying theory, about gravity. Now, in an IAU symposium about 12 years ago, I was struck by something that Jim Peebles said. He says that this works all works incredibly well. It all works beautifully, and we can make precision measurements of the cosmological parameters. But it does rely on this incredible assumption of extrapolating our laws of gravity by 15 orders of magnitude, which is a tremendous extrapolation. So you can ask yourself, is there any way of going beyond just assuming general relativity and statistical mechanics and making precision measurements? Can we go further? Can we test for general relativity? Can we constrain what the gravitational theory is on very large scales? So the outline of this talk will be as follows. I will try and give you a panorama of gravitation theory in cosmology, which has really emerged over the last 10, 15 years. I will argue that I want to focus my attention on. I want to focus on linear perturbations. I want to focus on the largest scales on weak perturbations and see what we can do with that. Other people might argue that we could look at different things. We might look at the abundance of clusters. We might look at nonlinear clustering. All this is fine, and I'm happy to argue with you whether that's a good idea or not, but that's not the focus of this talk. I will discuss how we might want to try and parameterize this immense space of theories that seems to have emerged over the last few decades. I will then describe how we might measure these parameters, what kinds of observations we might use, and then I will look to the future. For those of you who get restless in talks, I've numbered the transparencies, and I will finish at around 50. So you know where I'm going. This plot here is a plot, and I'm not sure you can see it. It's all quite bright, but this plot here is taken from the Decadal Review in Gravitation at the turn of the century. And on the x-axis, we have distance in meters. On the y-axis, we have the mass in grams of gravitating objects. And we've got a distribution of things that we know. This is where GR becomes really interesting. But one of the things that's emerged over the last 20 years is that there's this strange property when we look at certain regimes. It's convenient to define an acceleration scale. And what we find is that when this acceleration scale is of order 10 to the minus 10 meters per second squared, odd things happen. We find that there's evidence for dark matter. We find that there's evidence for dark energy. Now, I'm not going to make a case that this acceleration scale is fundamental. It's just a useful way to seeing to picking out where these things happen. And we can kind of plot that in a different way. We can plot this with length scale on the y-axis and acceleration scale on the x-axis. And down here is large scales, up there is small scales, small accelerations, large accelerations. And we find that these odd things, this evidence for the dark sector, seems to emerge around here. And so we can ask ourselves, this emergence of the dark sector, which we're all trying to explain, we're all trying to look for, is this a signal that something is going on with gravity? There are then two reasons for my becoming interested in this. First of all, I think that theory and observation are beginning to become precise enough to test gravity. And two, the evidence for the dark sector might be an indication that we may have gravity wrong on large scales. And that's going to be really the two motivations for this talk. Now, what do I mean by gravity and Einstein gravity? You've all learnt this. This is the Einstein-Hilbert action plus matter. And basically what you have is you have one metric, and stuff follows what metric tells it to do. It follows geodesic flows. It satisfies energy momentum conservation equations. And the field equations emerge from matching the Einstein-Hilbert tensor with the stress and the energy momentum tensor. And there are many, many ways we can screw around with this. For example, we can decouple the metric that comes into the Einstein-Hilbert action from the metric that goes into the matter action. We can consider two different metrics, and that has been done. And one of the most common and most popular theories is the scalar tensor theory, where you basically have one metric here and you have another metric there, and they're related by a conformal transformation which has a dynamics of its own. Another possibility is that you can play around with this, and instead of just having the Ricci scalar, you can have functions of the Ricci scalar or functions of any invariance of the Riemann tensor, and you can build these actions and see what comes out of that. You can play around with this and decide that actually you do not live in a four-dimensional space-time, you live in a higher-dimensional space-time, and that the action that you're seeing is some low-energy, four-dimensional manifestation of this. And this brings out a number of different properties, and so on and so on. So there are many ways you can play around with this. And there are many ways that you can play. There are some guiding principles about what you can do or what you can't do. You can sit down and establish what are the rules of the game. So if you sit down and you say that the only second-order local gravitational field equations derivable from an action containing solely the 4D metric tensor, the only thing you can get out of that is the Einstein equations plus a cosmological constant. Of course, you can start screwing around with those details. You can add in extra degrees of freedom. You can loosen up the number of dimensions. You can change the field equations that they're higher than second order. You can introduce non-locality. So there are ways of moving away from the Einstein-Hilbert action in quite well-defined ways. And this can be useful. This can be useful when you start exploring this general space of theories. With my collaborators, over a year, we decided that it was useful for what we were doing to just do an inventory of what's been done. And if you really want to see what's around now, and in particular, what's around that has importance for cosmology, you might want to follow up this archive. But we do have this immense space of gravitational theories. It's not complete. Yes?
So I just wondering, why do you think the theory of gravity I'm now discussed would be derivable from an action?
I completely agree. It doesn't have to be derivable from an action. And for the moment, I'm going to decide a set of rules which I'm going to work from.
Yeah, I'm just wondering about the motivation of that, because like any other theory I've now discussed, that, you know, is not really derivable from action.
It's right.
Like fluid dynamics, I mean, you can probably formulate an action for it, but it doesn't really mean it.
I think you're absolutely right, and you'll see the way that I actually then develop what we do is from the field equations. So we don't work from the action. Now, there are people who propose working from the action, and there is some use in getting something from an action because there are symmetries which may not be manifest in the field equations, which are obvious in the action.
But I'm just wondering whether that might be too restrictive.
It can be. The point of this beautiful transparency done by my student Tessa Baker is that, in fact, there are all these theories, but often you can map different theories onto each other. So you can map scalar tensor theories onto higher dimensional theories. You can map scalar vector tensor theories onto vector tensor theories. You can map theories with preferred frames onto Einstein ether theories. There are many connections between this. So maybe the space of theories is not as big as we think. And that is actually going to be quite important in what follows. Now, here's why I explain why I call this the Golden Age. In the 1960s saw the explosion of general relativity. People rediscovered general relativity and did wonderful things with it. They understood black holes, they understood the expansion of the universe, beautiful theorems linking different mathematical aspects which could then affect the way that people looked at observations. And one of the results of this explosion of general relativity was the emergence of many, many, many counter-theories. Many counter-theories which could be tested against general relativity. And so the game was that people would propose alternatives to GR, and then they would go out and devise and look at specific tests for each one of these theories. Now, Thorne, Will, and Nordfed, basing their work on Dickey's ideas of the 1960s, decided that there should be a unified framework for testing these theories. And they focused on small scales. They focused on small scales around a compact object in the non-relativistic regime, where V over C is small. And they proposed something called the parameterized post-Newtonian framework. And without going into detail, let me just explain the general idea. The general idea is that you can write down the metric and you can basically come up with a systematic way of adding in all the terms which may arise in these general theories. It doesn't cover all theories. And they're quite clear that it doesn't cover all theories. It covers a surprisingly large amount of theories. And you build it up in terms of potentials which you construct from the density field. For example, a classic, the easiest thing to look at is a spherically symmetric object or the space-time around a black hole. And in front of these corrections, you get these constants. And you get about 10 constants which quantify deviations from GR phenomenology. And what is interesting is these constants are often related to physical effects, to time dilation, to preferred frames. Now, the interesting thing about what they did is that this is kind of a halfway house between theory and observation. This is a table of this plethora of theories that were around in the 1970s. And it turns out that if you look at the PPN framework, you can calculate those various coefficients for each one of those theories. And many of them are zero, and others are very specifically related to parameters in that theory. So what you can do is you can pick your favorite theory at the time, and you know that the PPN parameters are going to be many of them are going to be zero, and some of them are going to have specific values. Now, I call this a halfway house because, on the other end, there was this emergence of tests of gravitational theory in the solar system and looking at systems like the Hulse-Taylor pulsar. And you can relate these different parameters to specific effects. You can relate them to the time delay and light deflection. You can, of course, relate it to the precession of the perihelion of Mercury or the orbital decay in binary pulsars. You can look at Earth's tides. You can look at many different things. And the point is you can find constraints on these parameters, and then these reflect automatically on the parameters on this large swathe of theories that you're looking at. So in the very least, if these parameters don't lie within the error bounds of this, you can discard them. And there's no flab. There's no flab in this. It's not like the errors on this are large, and so they contain lots of theories. They're incredibly rigorous. And if we'd gone away and gotten hold of each one of those specific theories and done the calculation on the parameters, we would have got the same errors. So there's no artificial prior uncertainty in this. It's a very clean connection between theory and observation.
So, I guess I just want to add a follow-up by the last parameter there.
Yes.
Prior that's derivable from an action principle or something like that.
Okay.
There is no independent test of that sigma 4.
No. I think I've added this, and it's a little bit of a distraction about the no prior, but if I have time, I'll explain what I mean by that. But the point that I'm making is you can constrain these parameters and see how that reflects on theories is as efficient as looking at each individual theories and getting constraints on the parameters. And that's why this is such an efficient way of working. Now, many of us in this room were brought up learning linear perturbation theory. And linear perturbation theory is wonderful and it's easy. It's easy because it's linear, and it's wonderful because you can use cosmological observations on large scale cosmological observations on large scales to constrain it. And let me just briefly explain what I mean by linear perturbation theory for those who don't work on it. That's the Einstein equation, and if you make certain assumptions about homogeneity and isotropy, your functions, your metric greatly reduces, as does your stress energy momentum tensor, and you end up with something like the Friedman equation. You might want to look at gravity waves or tensor fluctuations on that, and you end up with an incredibly simple equation for general relativity. And you might want to look at scalar modes, and if you look at scalar modes, it's slightly more complicated. You can write your metric in terms of 4 scalar potentials, which are a time-like, something that goes into the time-space-like, and 2 bits, almost like a trace in a traceless bit in the space-space part. And it turns out that not all of these potentials are important. You really only need to focus on 2 potentials because of reparametrization invariance, and you can construct 2 potentials, a phi and a psi, and the easiest way to think about that is they're just like the Newtonian potentials. It's the Newtonian potential that goes in the time-time part, and the Newtonian potential that goes in the space-space part. Just as an aside, it's useful to define this beast over here, and this beast over here is useful because this combination kills higher derivatives in some of the potentials that go in here, and it's useful also to define this. Again, I don't have time to go into the details, but these things will come into what we're going to look at. Now, just an aside, it would be lovely to test what's going on by looking at gravity waves. Gravity waves are pure. They're just these things that lie on space-time and evolve, even though there's a source term, which is an isotropic, a form of the anisotropic stress. Typically, that's zero, so we just have these things that evolve in space-time, and it would be lovely to test gravity waves with that. It's just not possible. The only way at the moment for looking at gravity waves on very large scales is by looking at the B mode in the CMB, and all we have is upper bounds, this forest of upper bounds here, and this is what is typically predicted from an inflationary theory. So unfortunately, at least for the moment, there's not much we can do with gravity waves. So we have to focus on the mess, which is the scalar modes. And how do we do that? Well, basically, we take, and this is where I say I don't really use an action principle to construct what I'm going to talk about. I can take the linearized Einstein equations, and on the left-hand side, I have a set of equations of PDEs for phi and gamma. Remember that gamma is a combination of phi and psi, and a bit that corrects for gauge invariance. On the right-hand side, I have the stress-energy-momentum tensor, where I have the density fluctuations in the density and momentum in the pressure and the anisotropic stress. Now, we have these four equations. It turns out that we can combine these two equations to construct an algebraic relation between the one of the Newtonian potentials and the gauge invariant density field, and we have another one, which is an algebraic relation between the two potentials and the anisotropic stress. So really, we don't have a set of PDEs here. We have a set of PDEs, but there's no time dependence. And this will be important later on when we look at this. So we can actually distill these equations into these two very simple equations. Now, this is the framework that we work with. And this is what we do to construct predictions of the CMB, to construct predictions of large-scale structure, etc. But we would like to do something with these equations that would let us have some kind of parametrized approach at deviations from these equations. And let me explain what I mean by doing something analogous to doing parametrized post-Newtonian. In parametrized post-Newtonian, what you do is you take the metric elements and you parametrize corrections to them. You end up with about 10 free numbers, free parameters. For each theory, most of them are zero and a few are non-zero. And you restrict you restrict your analysis of the theory to weak field regimes where potentials are small, and not only that, you restrict it to where velocities are small. Well, we can't do the same thing on cosmological scale because everything is time dependent. It all has to do with the evolution of the universe. So we opt to do the following. We opt to parametrize the field equations. And it turns out that we end up with up to 20 free functions, not free parameters. So already that's a complication. Again, when you look at specific theories, like I will show you, many of them are zero or hugely interrelated. And we're going to restrict ourselves to the linear regime. And so this is the playground for us to develop a framework which will be applicable to a restricted set of cosmological data, but I would argue very good cosmological data. And so how do we go about this? Turns out that any gravitational field equations you can write in this form. You can write them as an Einstein tensor plus the energy momentum tensor plus another tensor. And you can always write it, and you can, any example that you can think of, don't throw examples at me here now, because I can explain how you can do this. Any example you can think of, you can write in this way. And what I'm interested in is, and these are just a few examples that you can look at. What I'm interested in is looking at what happens at the linear level. So obviously, this will happen at the linear level. So the game is trying to understand what that is. Okay? And we need to build that somehow. And so there are considerations. So they have to contain metric perturbations, the phis and psis or the phi and gammas. They have to contain extra degrees of freedom. Because basically all the theories that we look at, all of them, end up including extra degrees of freedom. So you have to include these extra degrees of freedom. And then you have to add enough so that you can construct basically gauge invariant equations. You don't want odd stuff happening just because you haven't taken into account the coordinate invariants. So the game is to focus on that delta U. Now, that delta U is not a free-for-all. That delta U, because of the way we've constructed that equation, has to satisfy certain symmetries. For example, it has to satisfy the Bianchi identities, and these will impose additional constraints. Furthermore, and this is where you start to impose structure, in the same way that you did in PPN, you may decide that your theory is only second order, up to second order in the metric, plus extra degrees of freedom. That immediately tells you where to truncate this metric in terms of this tensor, in terms of what metric potentials you put in and extra degrees of freedom. So there are rules for building something like this up. Now, the extra degrees of freedom that I was telling you about. Actually, let's just look at see what this looks like. So I've now rewritten this so that you have the U00 up there. I call it U delta. Then you have a U theta, which is the zero I part. This is the trace part of the IJ part of the U, and this is the traceless part. Okay. And what you look at, what you see from them is that what you have is you have the linear terms. You have the phi, the gamma, the chi chi dot are the extra degrees of freedom. You've got the V, which has to be there to fix things. Then you've got these coefficients. This, for example, this J1. This J1 is like A, F, is merely a function of background quantities, of K and A, and field, the background fields that you have in them. So you basically can split each one of these things into a bit which has the metric potentials and a bit which has the extra degrees of freedom. And now the game is to try and find out what symmetries, what assumptions can collapse this into a much simpler expression. And this is work in progress. And we have collapsed it a fair bit. But all I can do is outline how we go about doing this. So first of all, the extra degrees of freedom. The extra degrees of freedom, they could be anything. For example, in scalar tensor, we have a scalar field. So there can be fluctuations in the scalar field. You can describe often fluctuations in extra degrees of freedom as a fluid. This is the case of, for example, Eddington-Born-Infeld gravity or DGP. In Einstein ether, what you have is you have fluctuations in the space-like part of the four vector. All of these theories have extra degrees of freedom, and you can basically package them into what these things are. So very generically, all these theories that we look at, they look like that. And the game is to try and understand what those coefficients. The Bianchi identities are then incredibly useful because they give us not only how this extra degree of freedom evolves, but how these coefficients might be related. So you've seen this. So we focused I briefly talked about these extra degrees of freedom. What about the metric potentials? What about the things that multiply the metric potentials? So we've got 12 metric potentials there. And it seems like, don't forget that these are functions of time. But again, it pays to look at what happens in specific theories. And again, let's focus on probably the simplest theory that many of you have looked at, which is the scalar tensor theory, Jordan Brand's Dickey theory. It's a theory where you have a time-varying Newton's constant and with a kinetic term. And it turns out that you can rewrite it in exactly that form. And what you find is that those 12 coefficients are actually all pretty much interrelated. F is a derivative, is a combination of derivatives. Look at A0, C0, D0, D1, C1, I0, they're all the same. In other words, there are only about two free functions that will describe scalar tensor theory. You can be ambitious and look at Horndesky theory. And for those of you who don't know what Horndesky theory is the most general action which leads to second with a scalar field and a metric, which leads to second order field equations. And it's a huge mess, but it has this fantastic thing in that it encompasses scalar tensor, F of R, covariant Galileans, kinetic braiding, all the dark energy models, chaos. Anyway, it's a lot. And it turns out that at the linear level, there are really only three functions of background of the expansion rate or of time which come into play. And if you look at, and you can write it this way, but the important thing is to look at what that U looks like. And again, you've got these 12 coefficients, and it turns out that they all look very similar. They've got 1 minus GT or 1 minus FT, and some of them are derivatives of the other. But you can basically, while in scalar tensor, I forget if it was one or two functions, in this case you've got three functions, and they're all intimately related. Which means a bit like PPN, you don't need all the functions. You only need a few functions. And the game then is to try and figure out in this multi-parameter space, multi-function space of gravity, what is the true subspace of theories that we need to look at. Hondesky, I think, was here at Waterloo. It's quite possible he was a mathematician at Waterloo. I think he did his PhD with, Lovelace, Claude Lovelace, someone like that in Florida. He left the field, and he's now an artist in New Mexico.
He discovered all these theories before all this.
This was the 1970s. This was a paper which was completely forgotten and was rediscovered about 3 years ago.
Did you read these?
All the good papers from Waterloo are completely forgotten.
Am I right? He was here, right?
He was
here. It's very interesting how this...
Lovelock was here, too.
Lovelock, okay. Then he worked with Lovelock. Yeah. No, he wrote these amazing, incomprehensible papers, but amazing, really amazing stuff. And people have rediscovered them. So, there is, of course, DGP, which has arisen and fallen. So we don't pay too much attention to DGP anymore, except for the fact that it's an interesting example. And again, you find tremendous symmetries between the coefficients. And a final example, and we've basically looked at many examples. Hoshava-Lifshitz is another example that we've just finished. And the game is it's a little bit like geology. We're trying to figure out, for lack of a simpler principle, what the symmetries are like in theory by theory and trying to pick out the common patterns. But again, it's incredibly simple. So the point being that the idea is to develop this formalism so that we can constrain these functions, and then they will tell us something about any theory of gravity, or if there is a deviation. Now, I want to contrast this with... anyway, this is just a schematic. This is my first keynote talk, so I learned to do this. But this is just an idea that you can have all these possible free functions. The possible space of all theories do not encompass the possible space of all free functions. They're going to be smaller dimension, a lower dimensional slice. You're going to constrain these coefficients with the observations, which is this green thing, and hopefully lies somewhere at that intersection. Now, there is an alternative approach, and the alternative approach is for me to remind you that when I wrote down the linear perturbation equations, the field equations, I said, actually, we only work with two equations, these two algebraic equations, and they are something like the generalized Poisson equation and the slip equation. And it's equal to zero here because the only way of getting non-zero in GR is if you have large anisotropic stresses driving it. So if you have the psi equals phi, then you can just get phi from the gauge invariant density. So one thing you could do, and I've listed the people who work on this alternative approach. You can test for violations of these equations. What does that mean? That means that you take the Poisson equation and you push this over here, and for gravity, this is for GR, it's equal to zero, and the slip equation is equal to zero. And so you can say, actually, let's test for deviations. Let's just put in arbitrary functions which parameterize deviations from these two equations, which is all you really need to solve linear perturbation theory. And then for dimensional reasons, you can say, well, you know, I've got phis and psis here and a phi here. Why don't I just make this a dimensional function times phi and a dimensional function times phi? And so I get something like that. I need to put the k squared in there. And you can rewrite these equations by bringing this over there, and dividing it out, and so on. And what you get is an equation that looks like that, which just looks like a Poisson equation, and an equation that looks like that. And so you end up with these two free functions. Now, this seems to be the simplest way of doing this. And you might argue that this would be a function of the scale factor of k of the background fields. You might want to combine these functions into a different combination where you have a Newton-Poisson equation of the combined metrics, and you have another free function, and this is particularly useful for certain observables. But the idea is the same, is you get these equations and you just bung in this free function. Now, this is useful, and it has been produced quite a lot of results, and it's fine if you want to look for deviations of these equations. But the problem is that when you look at any of the theories that I presented, the equations never look like that. They never look this simple. You have phi dot terms, you have extra degrees of freedom. And so if you want to rewrite any specific theory in this form, these functions here, the sigma, the mu, and the gamma, are not only functions of the background quantity, but they'll be functions of the initial conditions and the evolutions of the perturbations in the different fields. They will be, as my collaborator Konstantinos Skourdis has said, they will be environmentally dependent. So suppose you go away and you measure these things, you really do not know how to map it back onto theory space. And ultimately, that's what we want to do. We want to learn something about theory. And this is just... And so one of the approaches, which is the wise approach that has been taken by Kazuya Koyama and Rachel Bean and collaborators, is to say that's completely true. And so what we have to do about these functions is they will not tell us much about theory. Not only that, we have to be completely general. Because they depend on perturbations, they might have very weird spatial dependence, time dependence. And so we need to consider a general function, general parametrization of those things. And what they do is basically they take a principal component analysis in K and in time, and they just constrain modes. And that's quite useful because that will say gravity is really well constrained at this time on this scale, not very well constrained on that time, and that's useful. So this is an alternative approach. It's an alternative way which doesn't really map onto theory, and the motivation of the way that we're doing here is to learn from theory. So the final part of my talk is, how am I doing for time? 20 minutes, so that's good, all right. So at the moment, this has all been theory. But what we really want to do is we want to learn something about these free functions. And we can learn about these free functions in two ways. We can look at matter and we can look at light. And this is the Petern line element in the Newtonian conformal gauge, and you can map those directly onto those potentials that I've been working with. And we know that this very interesting thing, which is that for non-relativistic particles, they only feel the time-like bit of the metric perturbation, while for relativistic particles, they feel the time-like and the space-like. That's why where you get the factor of two from the Eddington experiment. And so by looking at different types of probes, we will probe different combinations of these gravitational potentials. So for example, if we look at CDM and baryons, we look at growth of structures, redshift space distortions, I'll explain what I mean by that, and peculiar velocities, we will be probing the first equation. If we look at light, if we look at the integrated Sachs-Wolfe in the CMB, if we look at lensing, we'll be probing the second equation. And again, let me remind you, the motivation for this is the huge success of using large-scale structure to make cosmological measurements, to make cosmological constraints. And so we're going to want to look at what we can do with the CMB and galaxies, and ways of looking at galaxies. And the primary thing that we will be looking at is how structure grows in these theories. Again, we're only looking at the linear regime. And in the linear regime, we basically, from the Euler equation, from the conservation of momentum, we have an equation that looks like that. It tells you how density perturbations react to the gravitational potential. And what we've shown is that the relationship between the gravitational potentials and density perturbations may change in different theories. And so by probing that thing there, we will be probing phi and psi. And not only that, that thing will be sensitive to the modified evolution of that thing over there. And so by looking at these two things, we will try and learn something about the growth of structure and modifications to gravity. The quantity to look at is basically the growth rate of structure, how structure collapses, how structure forms as a function of time. And it's useful to take the logarithmic derivative of the density fluctuation in terms of the scale factor. And to give you an idea of what it looks like, if we live in a zero lambda matter-dominated Einstein universe, that F is 1. Okay, F goes... the delta goes as the scale factor, so it's incredibly simple. If you have lambda, then that deviates from 1 in a very well-defined way. If you include modifications to gravity, it'll deviate as well. And so here I have a plot of, this is F over here, and I've multiplied it by the amplitude, sigma 8, amplitude of mass fluctuations at a given time, because ultimately that's what you really measure. But forget the sigma 8 for now. And as a function of redshift, and these different lines are lines which correspond to different possible modified theories of gravity. So the idea is that if we can measure this beast here, we can pick out, we can say something about how the growth rate of structures evolving on how gravity is behaving. So let's go back to what started this all for me, which is the cosmic microwave background. For those of us brought up in the early 90s, the cosmic microwave background is the P. Yes?
On the previous slide, you said F was 1 if everything was normal.
F was 1 if omega lambda is 0. So Einstein to Sitter universe. Einstein to Sitter universe.
So F is certainly not 1 because you're measuring it at 0.4.
Set, over here.
Yeah.
I don't understand. This is for a series of non... what I'm saying is for GR in an Einstein de Sitter universe, so no lambda, it's 1. Now, there's pretty strong evidence that we don't live in Einstein de Sitter universe. And then what you find is...
But sigma 8 would be something anyway. So
sigma 8 will be something else. So, but no, but just to answer you... Can I write here? Am I allowed to write here? So F is 1 if omega equals to 1, okay? Omega equals to 1, and what I mean by that is omega lambda equals to 0. But it turns out that F in a lambda universe, sorry, is something like that. Okay? And you can work this out into something like 0.6 or 0.55 or whatever. But it's definitely not 1 in what we see now. The point is that modifications to gravity will lead to deviations from this expression as well. And that's why there is a family of curves. There. So we look at the CMB. Now, we could argue that gravity has been modified all along. But let's not be too ambitious at the moment and just see, what if we assume that gravity has only been modified since the onset of dark energy over the last few expansion times? Let's start looking for it there. Then we can start worrying about looking for it further back. And what happens there is that most of the effects will be on very large scales. And what they'll do is they'll affect these very large scales in the CMB, and they'll affect it through the change in the growth rate of perturbations, which will affect something called the integrated Sachs-Wolfe. And the integrated Sachs-Wolfe is schematically that, is as your photon passes through space-time, it'll probe gravitational potentials, it'll probe the time variation of gravitational potentials, the change in the growth rate of gravitational potentials will affect these very large scales. And so you can get effects, different effects, a variation on large scales. Of course, there is a fundamental limitation on these very large scales. You're limited by cosmic variance. You only have one snapshot of the sky. You only have a limited number of modes which you can constrain. And so there's a you can make the best experiments in the world. There's a fundamental limitation on how well you can do. Well, another way that you might want to look for it is the effect on lensing of the CMB. You have the CMB, this wall of light coming from when the universe was about 400,000 years old, and it's going through these time-varying potentials, it'll affect the way that that light is lensed. And you can work out what is the effect on lensing from modifications of gravity. And it turns out they're not dramatic. And so even when we increase our measurement of lensing with Planck, CMB lensing will not give us very tight constraints on these large scales. Yet the large scales are really important. And we're up against this problem, right? The large scales are very important. This is, again, P of K, and this is K. And I've plotted this, for those of you who understand, in synchronous gauge. And what you see is that you can have very large effects on large scales from modifying gravity. But what you really measure is these scales here. It's between 0.01 to 0.1 in inverse wavelength. And we're talking about things which would begin to kick in below 10 to the minus 2, all right? This is the result from the recent Boss paper, and this is from the systematics paper. And this is fascinating in how little we've made progress in understanding the large scale, the very large scales from galaxy surveys. They split the data set into the north and the south bit, and we have the blue bit turns over like that, and the red bit just goes up. So past the turnover, they're just over one sigma away from each other, which is not a big deal, but it means we have no constraints on very large scales. So it really seems that it's going to be very difficult to constrain very large scales from galaxy surveys. There are other ideas, and this is where I think this becomes interesting. And again, this echoes what was going on in the 1960s and 70s. people have begun to become clever about looking for things. They haven't sat down and said, oh, there's galaxy service, peculiar velocity, CMB, blah, blah, blah. They've started thinking of different ways of probing large scales. And one possible way is looking at neutral hydrogen. You look at neutral hydrogen in the last few redshifts, and it should trace galaxies pretty well. You really don't want to look for individual galaxies. What you want to do is you want to do like a CMB experiment on very large scales where you only look for the 21-centimeter line suitably redshifted. And you make a map. You just make a map. And by basically varying the frequency very tightly, you'll be doing tomography of very large scales. This is something that actually has been pioneered by one of your colleagues at CETA, Whaley Penn, Jeff Peterson, Richard Battier. A few people have actually looked at this. And I think these are results from the Nature paper 2008, which is their first attempt at doing a total intensity mapping experiment, where they've actually been able to measure a correlation function. This is scales in megaparsec. This is about 10 megaparsec, and this is an amplitude. So this is just a proof of concept. And the idea is, where can we go with something like this? It's far cheaper, but far, far cheaper than building a satellite or building these huge surveys that people are talking about. Of course, the thing that has really taken off over the last four years is when we look at these redshift surveys, we look at them, we make a map of the distribution of galaxies, and we place them at an angular position in the sky and at a redshift. Now, what we would really like to do is an angular position of the sky and a distance. We use the redshift as a proxy, and we use Hubble's law to convert between one and the other. But each one of these objects is affected by a peculiar velocity, by some kind of infall. On large scales, this infall won't overcome the Hubble flow, and so you get a slight deformation. So, for example, suppose you have a mass over there. There will be some infall from the top, some infall from the bottom, and you'll see that on large scale, things are squashed. On small scales, where the gravitational potential can be much larger, you might have an overcompensation, and what you end up is having a stretched effect like this. You can look at the correlation function of galaxies at a given redshift, and what you find is that on small scales, you get this here, the fingers of God, but on large scale, you get this squashing. And the idea is that by fitting out this squashing, we can fit out the amount of gravitational collapse, we can measure the growth rate. And this is the state of play of this. This is the growth rate without the sigma 8, and this is the redshift. And a bunch of experiments, galaxy survey, redshift-based distortion measurements. And of course, these are early days. You can't really do anything with this at the moment. But it's one of the tools that we can use. Of course, like the CMB 20 years ago, the weak lensing of distant galaxies is one of the fields that's really taking off. And the idea is that you look at very distant galaxies, and you look at how they are, their ellipticities are correlated between each other, because these correlations between these ellipticities may tell you something about the intervening distribution of potential wells. And of course, you can use that to test gravity. Unfortunately, weak lensing is not there yet. And just to give you an example, this is results from the Cosmos data by Schrabach. At the top is the constraint on sigma 8 from WMAP. And on the bottom, you have the constraint on sigma 8 from the Cosmos data. And it's still not competitive at all. Things will change. There are a lot of systematics that remain to be understood, but things will change. Of course, there's no reason just to focus on individual types of data sets. And one interesting result that came out over the last few years was based on some work proposed by Bean and Dodelson, Liguori. This is terrible because I've forgotten the first author. And they proposed that if you take a cross-correlation between weak lensing and basically the velocities of galaxies, you have a very firm prediction for GR. You also have reasonably firm predictions for different theories. And so they went away and did that with Sloan data. And these are the measurements. GR is the solid line here, and it's still not competitive. But this, again, this is the idea. The idea is that you do cross-correlations of data sets, and you can start to disentangle the different potential wells. So this is the really disappointing thing. So after all that hubris, the incredible plots from the CMB that you've got, it's just like the Hulse-Taylor pulsar. I don't think at the moment we have any constraints on on gravity. And this is an attempt at using basically most of the data out there at the moment and really being agnostic about where it comes from. And we can't even constrain the effect. We can parameterize, we can even simplify the parameterization a bit like in the alternative approach, and we're still not getting competitive constraints. So and the question is then, will we? And that's one of the things that we have to figure out. That's a really good question. So there are no constraints on large scales, right? That's so you're saying is you can't compete with anything on large scales. Yeah, yeah. So competitive to lab constraints or PPM constraints or things like that. Yeah, yeah. That's what I mean, but that's a good question. That's a good point. So there is no competition.
What's the y-axis?
Yeah, what are the axes?
I can tell you. So this is an attempt to kind of condense all that mess at the moment into two parameters, a bit like what's been done by a bunch of people. The effective Newton constant at redshift zero, and this is the slip. This is the mismatch between the gravitational potentials, phi and psi. We know that for GR it should be zero. And you should look at the green line there, the green contours. What does the future hold? Well, there's this juggernaut of cosmological experiments and data happening over the next 10, 15 years. There are a bunch of them which are, for example, soon CFHTLS will put out data. I'm not sure it'll be competitive for doing this yet, but you know there'll be some first attempts. The Dark Energy Survey, I think, is coming online. As you all know, Euclid has been approved, and there's work ahead trying to push forward. And one of the interesting things about Euclid is when it was finally sold to ESA, one of the main four topics was testing general relativity. And it's something that came out of the blue, but the observers really embraced and actually pushed for it. And finally, there is the mega experiment, the one that I really love, which is the Square Kilometer Array, which is this beast, this radio survey of radio galaxies, where not only will you be able to do total intensity mapping, you'll be able to do surveys of 10 to the 9 galaxies. It really is a humongous experiment, which will probably really come to fruition in the middle of the next decade. Just to give you an idea, for example, with Euclid, these lines here is what you would get from redshift space distortion. These dots over here is what you might get from Euclid. And so the question you might ask is, how does that translate in constraints on gravity? No one's really done that exercise yet. This is from weak lensing from Euclid, and so you have these different theories, and you have these minute errors that you, in principle, if you know how to deal with the systematics, you might be able to really pin down theories. So this is my summary. This is a golden age because we, all of a sudden, we've realized that we can test gravity again in a completely different regime. There's this plethora of ideas that have emerged because of the dark sector, and there's an immense landscape of theories. There's no point in going at it theory by theory. There's no point because I think we learn more if we can come up with a coherent way of testing for these different theories given these cosmological observations. I think we should focus on the linear scales because even though that's probably where we have the most limited data, it's also the cleanest data, and we know how to calculate that. And there's a way in which you can construct a framework in that regime. The signatures will appear in the growth rate of structure on very large scales, and there are a plethora of new experiments to look forward to, as I showed in the last transparency. These are my collaborators, and I'll end there.
Any questions? Pedro, Issa. You've moaned before that we don't have a similar thing as this PPF for dark energy, for W, you know, we have these not very useful W parameterizations. But then you said quintessence and not modifying gravity fits into this framework.
Yes.
So why don't we just forget about W altogether and always think about quintessence in frame quintessence as modified gravity, and then we've got this systematic way of looking at it.
The thing is, I think it's much easier for quintessence, right? It's much easier for quintessence or for dark energy. Because the equation of state pretty much encompasses a lot. Of course, you need to add up things like, as you know, sound speeds and things like that. But you only have two or three parameters will cover a pretty large space of theories. It is absolutely true that that will be subsumed, that could be subsumed by this. So that's one thing that you could do. You had a question then? Yep.
Yeah, just in the PPM program, over the years, empirical bounds were placed on the parameters, we now have them. So what's the state of the art for PPF in terms of empirical bounds? Or is that too premature?
Too premature. I mean, I think I would argue that we are the first people to think of it in this way, as an analogy to PPM, and parameterizing it this way.
So there's not even yet a single empirical bound?
No, and even in the other way, it's very interesting because it depends on the assumptions that you make about time evolution. You will see some talks where people are claiming that they've got constraints of 10% on the varying Newton's constant. But if you look at what they've done, they've considered a very simple, they've either considered a constant modification in time or some, the moment you start including linear quadratic corrections, it just all blows up.
So then the follow-up question is, when will it not be premature? When do you anticipate filling in the chart?
So this is two steps. First of all is, will we ever get good constraints from this, right? And so I argue that the only way to do this is go through this route and then forecast what we might expect from experiments. And that's what we're doing now. And it may be that we will figure out that experiments that we thought were fantastic won't actually bring us a lot, but we still don't know. I would say that by 2025, we will have quite a lot of data. We will have some data by 2020. Sorry, João was first. Yeah.
Well, we probably know that by now people think PPN is a terrible way to parameterize deviations in the solar system. But there are many theories which simply, that's not the phenomenology. So there's always this danger when you come up with some kind of general framework. And the obvious one here, just by looking at this, is suppose you're interested in Brayton Lorentz invariants.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Then all this stuff just basically not be the right way to.
But we know how to add Lorentz invariant breaking terms, right?
But these parameters are not the ones that really capture.
No. But you're saying that PPN is—it's not a terrible way. I think it's pretty much acknowledged that it's surprisingly how general it covers theories. There are theories that are not included by it.
So for example, modified dynamics
doesn't include it, but that's one case, right?
That's one case.
Yeah, and there are terms with Yukawa potentials.
Yeah.
Doesn't work very well. But there are all these other theories. So I very much like PPN. I can't make the case this will cover all theories. What we can do is figure out how to systematically add. And so, for example, preferred frame theories, I think we know how to add to this.
Yeah. So, suppose we are in 2040. And then you analyze things and you say, all right, the GR looks like there is a deviation.
There is.
Yes. I mean, how can you refute the alternative hypothesis? The GR is totally right, and there are like new components in stress energy, maybe mundane, maybe there's some new components, large scales and so on. So how to separate the change in the theory per se from new components?
I totally know what you're saying, and I don't have an answer for you, and it's analogous to the kind of problems you have with PPM. And if you add in an extra force, you can mimic some of the effects that you would get. You could still have GR plus an extra force.
I would say that at least in PPM, with these observations, we observe things that are around, going around and around.
Yes.
The analog would be, if we had so short lived, then we see like
yes.
A really small fraction of the trajectory, how much of it is the initial condition?
There are two different problems. One is the data ever going to be good enough for us to make strong statements? Okay, and that we need to check. The other is, can this be confused by other things? Again, I say this is like PPM. If you have an extra force, it can it can mimic some of the deviations that you get in PPM.
Because you see, you were very generous for those modifications. I could say, well, all of them have one of this or that problem from the point of view of theory. Right?
Yep.
And I would say, well, GR doesn't have it, right? And then I can start adding gravitational waves, whatever, on top. And this would probably be a more conservative.
It is, and I think you can look at this, and you can impose what is acceptable or not. So you can decide that GR is already done, and that's fine. Then it's the end of the conversation. But I would argue that you wouldn't do that. I would argue that you would sit down and say, well, you've been too generous. I would only want to consider this subset of theories. And if you did that, you would be imposing extra structure on these coefficients. So I think the formalism would still work.
You said a lot about perturbation and growth and perturbations, which is fine. But what about tests through the expansion rate?
The thing about
the measurements coming up and existing.
Yeah, but if you think about it, you're measuring one function of time, right? You're measuring one function of time, and basically you can show that measurements of you've only got one function of time, and it's very easy to get it to generate.
You make something that fits the expansion rate, yep, but not fit the growth, and vice versa.
Yes, and so of course that will be useful, but that I don't think that's where you're going to pick it up. And so, for example, when you look at redshift space distortions, one of the things that I think I've shown is that if you do not use some constraints from the expansion rate on, for example, W, the equation of state, then your errors in these extra parameters are humongous. So you do need things like that. You do need D of Z, DL of Z, or DV of Z, or things like that.
You emphasize on the linear perturbation for making this modified gradient models. On the other hand, in the linear part, you have the big error bars.
Yeah, but linear goes. Yeah. That, so that's what we're up against.
So what's your prediction for the next generation observation? How well they decrease the error bars?
So I don't. Unfortunately, I don't have plots to show you how well we'll do. My view is that we will never really, with galaxy surveys, we'll never really make it over the turnover. So we need to think of it in a different way. I mean, linear goes all the way further down, right?
Yeah.
You know, it goes through the barren acoustic oscillation peaks. You have data there which you can work with. But the very large scale past the turnover, I think we've got to be clever about it. And one possibility is this total intensity mapping. It's in its infancy. People haven't actually predicted how well we could do with it, but it seems to be one of the few possibilities of trying to get over that turnover.
Maybe you touched on it before, but is it fair to take away from this talk, in a conservative way, without any extra fields, the Einstein plus cosmological constant is still in the game?
Totally. It's not only that, it's a fantastic fit to the data.
So, I guess there's no more questions. So I'm going to ask a very long-winded and open-ended question. So I want to play devil's advocate and compare this with particle physics, with the very standard model of particles with devil. So you have two types of theories in particle physics. You have renormalizable theories and non-renormalizable theories. And the difference between renormalizable and non-renormalizable theories is that renormalizable theories, like they have to mention this coupling constants. So you have to pick a handful of dimensionless coupling constants, and the number of terms are picked by the symmetries. And that's it, that fixes the theory. That happens for QED, for QCD, for standard model. Now, the non-renormalizable theories, however, could have dimensionful scales. And they work well as long as you're far away from that scale. But as soon as you get close to that scale, then all the Taylor expansions that you can write down in terms of those in powers of energy divided by those scales will break down because you have infinite number of terms that become comparable to each other. So I think that's similar to comparing PPN to PPF, because in PPN you're actually dealing with dimensionless numbers. You are not actually introducing a new scale. And that's why actually you're so limited, you have only 10 parameters or so. It has, of course, its own limitations, but these are dimensionless parameters. And that's why it can work so well, because you're limited. But then if you want to introduce new scales, then the problem is similar to what happens in effective field theory is called to their cutoffs. You actually don't really understand the theory because there are all these free functions. And in fact, what happens in the case of particle physics is that you don't really know what the degrees of freedom are as you approach that scale. For example, I would argue this might be similar to trying Taylor expand coupling constant for Fermi interaction close to its W boson mass. And you can try to do that, and you can fit for basically terms order by order, but we know it's a failed program in the hindsight, because what you need to do is actually come up, express things in terms of your degrees of freedom. And that's kind of, I think that's the comparison, that do you have a scale or don't you have a scale? In terms of, for PPF, if you have a scale, because you have explicit time dependence, this gives the scale to all your functions. And then the question is, do you think this program will succeed because it has a scale?
Okay, so I have to, you have to be really careful. People sometimes feel that because we're doing this effective thing, that they can bring in effective field theory. We're doing a quadratic action. We're doing a quadratic action where we're imposing the symmetries. First of all, second, this is a classical, we're doing classical equations. There's no quantum here. So all these arguments about renormalizability, they really don't apply here. They really don't apply. You're talking about scales, right? These functions are dimensional. The way that we set it up, these functions are dimensionless. Okay, they're dimensionless. And what is the scale that goes in there? Well, there's obviously the Hubble constant is a possible scaling. You can add other scales in here, and that is the game of how you actually parameterize these functions. You will look at different regions of parameter space depending on how you do that. But I think you've really got to be careful. There are papers talking about effective field theory approach to doing cosmological perturbation. I don't think there's any relationship with this.
I'm not trying to say it has anything to do with quantum correction.
So then we go back to the comparison with PPN. It's entirely analogous to PPN, except as you say, PPN has this tremendous advantage, which is V over C, right? V over C really gives you a way of ordering.
It's a scale thing that I think.
Well, no,
your theory is if you write an action or field equation for your theory, you have a scale.
Yes.
Which is either a scale of lambda or something.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
And PPN doesn't have any scale.
No, but it has a small parameter, which is V over C. It expands in V over C, and it's incredibly useful because of that. It's a really useful way of organizing terms. I would argue that the way that we're doing here, at the moment, it's the best we can do. Using gauge form invariants and having these series of principles, or like Sean, we might want to add in preferred frames, but there are a series of rules which collapse things. There are scales in there, but the way that we've written this is as dimensionless functions. So I think it is very much like PPN in spirit.
Any further questions? Question: you're using linear perturbation theory, so you're defining these gauge invariant potentials, and actually the effect of any modified theory of gravity goes into these potentials, that in turn would affect your growth and perturbations. But is there a unique way of defining gauge invariant potentials? Mm. You had a slide where you showed one way of doing that. One could imagine having more.
No, there are different ways of defining. Yes. We chose this because it maps very nicely onto Newtonian
gauge.
Yeah.
Doesn't it affect if you chose another way?
It might, but you're allowed to come up with another parameterizing it in terms of I mean, in principle, the final result has to be the same, right? But
Any questions?